penniless, and barely out of his teens, having just turned 20. But Balasha found him so fresh and enthusiastic, so full of colour and so clean, that she took him back with her to Belaini, the Cantacuzeni ancestral manor deep in the Romanian countryside. There, cut off from the world as snow piled up to the windowsills, they settled into a life of artsy aristocracy. Balasha spent the mornings painting, often portraits of Paddy, while Paddy worked at translating a friend's French novel into English. By the same instinct that prompted Paddy to adopt his alias of Michael at the beginning of his journey, he now dropped it. His life on the road was over. Content with a woman and life of his dreams, he showed no sign of straying. Until, 4 years later, a new adventure called. Chapter 19. Situation here ugly. Paddy's first message to HQ after arriving on Crete. Ugly barely cut it. Paddy had been surprised to find gorillas wading past him to escape the island while he was wading in. Satan and his family were eager to get aboard the British boat, while grumpy old Colonel Papadakis was stewing on the beach because he'd just been told there was no more room for him and his followers. A lot had changed since Chan's moment of daring do in the mayor's office, Paddy would soon learn. None of it good, and much of it due to the Russians, and a murderous thug known as the Turk. Chan filled Paddy in during their long night of drinking and storytelling in the cave outside Yarakari. The Germans had gotten off to a late start on Operation Barbarossa, exactly as Hitler feared, so instead of blitzing into Moscow, they'd been socked by snow and were now stuck in a muddy, bloody, frozen-toed death slog. Hitler was facing a campaign that could last years rather than months, so to rest some of his troops, he'd begun rotating them with tours of duty on Crete. Frostbitten and battle-scarred, these frontline survivors showed up with a score to settle and zero patience for any shepherd shenanigans. Crete was now the biggest transit depot in the Mediterranean, and the Germans intended to lock it down once and for all. "Better to shoot once too often than once too seldom," was their standing order, and their approach to bandits was even more vicious. If you can't grab a ghost, grab his family. That's why Satan and Colonel Papadakis had to get off the island until the heat died down. Their children, parents and neighbours were in danger of being seized. Since it was the German practice to seize the relatives of a wanted man as hostages, Chan explained, the colonel's family had taken the precaution of leaving their home in Kalakitri to join him in the mountains and were now living as he was, like hunted refugees out in the open. Along Crete's northern coast, the mysterious Gestapo sergeant, Fritz Schubert, was operating his own reign of terror. Born in Turkey, raised in Germany, fluent in English and Greek, a Nazi true believer, the Turk was a spectre who haunted cafes and village squares. With so many refugees from burnt-down villages turning up in the cities, it was hard to tell the difference between a survivor and a spy, and the Turk's walnut skin and Mediterranean savvy gave him natural camouflage. The name Fritz Schubert became anathema to the people of Rethymno, as he would be to all of Crete, one war chronicler reported. The Turk was now equated with barbarity. Terrible as he was, the Turk was still no rival to the Butcher of Crete, General Friedrich Wilhelm Müller. The Butcher and Paddy arrived within weeks of each other in the summer of 42, and that is where any similarity ended. Paddy's assignment was to match wits with the Butcher and undermine his command of Crete. But frankly, they couldn't be more mismatched. Müller was afraid of nothing, least of all war crimes. He starved civilians by burning their winter food. He torched their homes. He turned any village suspected of sheltering rebel fighters into a death camp, murdering everyone, infants, elderly, the disabled. Any survivors who returned to bury the dead were shot on sight. Paddy, on the other hand, had quickly established himself from the start as a cheerfully useless soldier. The Dirty Tricks squad wasn't his first choice. Like Chan, he'd washed up in the unit only because he was so inept everywhere else. He'd originally volunteered for the Irish Guards because he liked the snazzy cap and tunic. "I thought I might as well die in a nice uniform," he explained. But army life, according to Artemis Cooper, came as a severe shock to his system. Paddy managed only 1 month of training before spending the next three in the hospital. His official assessment ranked him as below average. Once again, some combination of failure, death, and disgrace loomed in Paddy's future, so he decided to try a fresh path before it was too late. The regular army wasn't for him, but the irregular might be a different story. Thanks to his flair for foreign languages, he managed to follow in the footsteps of other misfits and get a transfer to the firm. Now, finally, he was in a situation perfectly suited for his natural gifts, a place where imagination and resourcefulness mattered more than blind obedience. All he had to do was focus a little and learn exciting stuff like forgery, demolition, and knife fighting. Except not even that could hold Paddy's attention. On the day France fell, Paddy's fellow trainees were in turmoil, wondering how their country would survive without its staunchest ally. Paddy, meanwhile, was working on a poem about a fish pond he'd seen in the Carpathians. He only heard the news later that night. Chan liked Paddy immediately. Sure, Paddy was a show-off and a chatterbox, but that's because he was addicted to drama. If there wasn't any at hand, Paddy would whip some together himself. Paddy lived for romance, which meant he was up for anything. "This charm of his was still apparent beneath his shabby disguise," Chan explained. "Though we all wore patch breeches, tattered coats and down-at-heel boots, on him these looked as frivolous as fancy dress. His fair hair, eyebrows and moustache were dyed black, which only added to his carnivalesque appearance, and his conversation was appropriately as gay and as witty as though we had just met each other, not in a sordid little Cretan shack, but at some splendid ball in Paris or London." During that boozy, all-night debriefing, Chan told Paddy how they'd take on the butcher. They'd split the island between them, with Chan in the west and Paddy in the east. Whenever the butcher was hot on Paddy's trail, Chan and his men would erupt from hiding and draw them off in the other direction. They'd keep the butcher's forces zigzagging back and forth through the mountains, which meant German fortifications along the coast would be underprotected and ripe for spying eyes and Cretan hit-and-run attacks. Any German troops in transit to Africa or any convoys refueling for the east would be detected by Chan's operatives and become sitting ducks for Allied attack planes. Chan and Paddy hoisted their cigarette tin cups in a toast. "By the time that raki was finished," Chan would recall, "and as I fell asleep on my narrow ledge of twigs, I could not be sure whether it was the strong spirit, Paddy's company, or the prospect of Egyptian fleshpots that was responsible for the happiest night I had so far spent on Crete." A few nights later, Paddy was burrowed into a tiny cave for the night when he heard a faint crackling in the brush. He yanked his pistol and took aim at the entrance. But before he could shoot, something scuttled in beneath his line of fire. In the dim light, Paddy glimpsed a sweat-streaked face and black eyes glinting with, as he put it, embers of mischief. He drew down. George Sikondakis had just trotted 50-some miles over the mountains in old boots held together with baling wire. His clothes were as ragged as his shoes and stuffed with secret messages he'd brought for Paddy from other resistance fighters. As George began to dig out the tiny slips of paper, Paddy burst out laughing. George kept putting a finger to his lips and glancing mock-fearfully over his shoulder, living up to his code name, Bertoldulus, or the clown from an Italian comedy, because he was brave enough to make fun of how scared he was. George had survived plenty of close shaves, including being stopped by a German sentry for questioning while his boots were stuffed with secret maps. That's why, besides the clown, George was also called the change bug. He'd shown a magical ability to spirit himself out of impossible jams, so far. Cramped by the low, dripping ceiling, Paddy and George and two local partisans stretched out to have a drink of raki and munch some almonds, while George waited for the sun to set for his return trip. Paddy marveled at George's stamina and ingenuity, his ability to run for hours at eagle's height and consistently outthink, outmaneuver, and out-endure German manhunts. George didn't shrug it off. He knew the value of what he knew.
"I felt as if I were flying," he liked to say, "running all the way from the top of the White Mountains to Mount Ida. So light and easy, just like drinking a cup of coffee."
George kept Paddy amused, sharing the only complete sentence he knew in English.
"I steal grapes every day."
As it got dark, George rolled Paddy's replies into tight little twists and hid them in his clothes. By day, Crete belonged to the butcher. By night, George and the shepherds ran free again.
When the moon rose, he got up and threw a last swig of raki down his throat with the words, "Another drop of petrol for the engine," Paddy recalled.
Then he raised a finger, whispered,
"The intelligence service,"
and was gone.
"A few minutes later," Paddy continued, "we could see his small figure a mile away, moving across the next moonlit fold of the foothills of the White Mountains, bound for another 50-mile journey."
Chapter 20.
"You really grow to love George, don't you?" Chris White said, as we inched along a thin goat track on the cliffs above Sfakia.
Sun glare and sweat were scorching my eyes, but Chris seemed unbothered.
"Such warmth and humour. He's a true Greek hero. Honest, but a trickster. Brave, but goofy."
Awful climbs on crumbling footing, I'd begun to see, put Chris in a meditative mood. Several times along this same cliff face, I'd been frozen in place, convinced there was no way forward that wouldn't end in freefall, while far ahead I could hear Chris's voice fading around a bend as he motored along obliviously, chatting about his old job working with the homeless in Miami Beach, or his recent fascination with clinical research into root causes of good luck. Visual receptiveness is key, apparently, along with extensive kinship bonds. Personally, I was fixated on how George could handle a trail like this with a girl on his back. George couldn't have weighed more than 130 pounds, but he'd once saved a friend's daughter by piggybacking her up these mountains with the Turk and his Gestapo band hard on his heels. George had been standing sentry early one morning when he heard a patter of gunshots. The Turk had tortured a Cretan prisoner into leading them to a guerrilla hideout, but made the mistake of shooting at a villager they spotted on the trail, giving George a chance to sprint back and sound the alarm.
"In a moment, all our men were gathered along the height, opening fire on a party of Germans and Italians," George recalled.
One guerrilla hollered to George to alert the nearby village. George arrived to find a friend's wife fleeing with her two little girls, so George and another man hoisted the girls on their backs and ran for it. They made the woods just in time.
"The Germans, having cut off the upper villages, were streaming south from every direction," George recalled.
George headed toward a hamlet he thought would be safe, but veered away when he heard distant screams and the roar of flames. The Germans had already arrived and were burning villagers to death in their own homes. Slipping and dodging, George snaked his little escape party through the dragnet and reached the remote home of one of his aunts. There, the young girl slid down from George's back to safety.
Purely on a strength and skill level, I didn't have to guess what that rescue was like. I could feel it. My boots were struggling for grip along the same cliffs, possibly the same trail, and I was carrying a pack roughly the weight of a small girl. I hadn't stood guard duty the night before or begun my day with a high-speed mountain traverse to save my friends from German stormtroopers, but already my legs were burning, my balance was shaky, and every step, no matter how slow, seemed too quick to be safe. That was a simple genius of the Chris White immersion method. It got to the bottom of the historical questions, the whos and wheres and whens of the traitor Alexio, the guerrilla chieftain Banduvas, the frightened young Katsias girls, the villagers of Kali Sikia and Nisi, so we could then zero in on the far trickier mystery. How? How did they actually pull it off? David Bell had a clue. David grew up in the outskirts of Paris, in a rough neighborhood that was even rougher for half-Vietnamese kids like him. When he got tired of being roughed up by bullies, David decided to do something about it. He teamed up with a band of other mixed-race kids to create what he called a training method for warriors. His inspiration was a mysterious stranger, someone David had heard amazing stories about, and a few times even seen in the flesh, his father, Raymond. Raymond Bell was born in Vietnam to a French military doctor and a Vietnamese mother. During the First Indochina War, the Bells had to flee for the border. Somehow, Raymond was separated from the family and ended up, at age 7, as a boy soldier in the French colonial army. Training was savage and effective.
"It was walk or die," David Bell would say. "Survival of the fittest."
In the mayhem of a jungle fight against Viet Minh guerrillas, the boys were told it would be every man for himself.
"He started training like a maniac," David recalled his father saying. "At night, when other kids were asleep, he would get out of bed to go run in the woods, climb on trees, do jumps, push-ups, balance. He would never stop, repeat his moves 20, 30, 50 times."
It worked. Raymond survived the war, and when the French were chased out of Vietnam, he escaped on a refugee boat and made his way to Lyon. There, his jungle-honed natural movement skills qualified him to become a member of the Sapeurs-Pompiers, Paris's elite paramilitary rescue squad. Fearless and nimble, Raymond became the squad's go-to man whenever a mission looked impossible. Once, he cat-footed far out on a bridge and managed to pull a suicidal woman to safety. What perplexed David wasn't his father's heroics, but his mechanics. How on earth do you balance with one arm on a spider web of steel when a woman is trying to hurl both of you into the river?
"When I was young, I was doing parkour," Raymond explained. "What is parkour?" David asked.
"Parkour, it's like in life. You have obstacles and you train to overcome them. You search for the best technique. You keep the best, you repeat it, and then you get better."
David had to figure out the rest on his own, because his superstar dad was rarely around. David teamed up with other outcast boys, and together they began recreating Raymond's survival challenges in the streets around their homes. They called themselves the Yamakasi, a Lingala word from the French Congo meaning strong man, strong spirit, and their homemade training method for warriors would go on to become the open-air, underground fight club known as parkour. Somehow, this back-alley art with no rules, no training manual, and, God forbid, no competitions, travelled from the mean streets of France to a drugstore in Pennsylvania farm country. Like the original Yamakasi, the two guys I met in the parking lot were using their own bodies to discover the most animal-efficient way to fly over, around, and under the hard edges of the city landscape the way monkeys tumble through the trees.
"I got into it because I was so fat," Neil Schaefer told me outside the Rite Aid. He'd begun partying after high school, and by age 20 had bloated up from 175 pounds
to 240. One afternoon, he was in the park watching some strangers Kong vault picnic tables. They charge a table, plant their hands, and shoot both feet through their arms like gorillas and fly off the other side. And Neil was talked into giving it a try. Neil was shocked to discover that, even out of shape, once he got over his fear, he could master skills that at first looked impossible. Well, maybe not master. You're on this endless trajectory where you're always getting better, but it's never good enough, Neil explained. That's what's so exciting. As soon as you land one jump, you can't wait to try it again. You're always looking for ways to make it cleaner, stronger, flow into your next move. Neil became a member of a local parkour tribe that likes to train after midnight, when the city is all theirs. Whenever a police car prowls by, they drop to the ground and bang out push-ups. No matter what time it is, no one bothers you when you're exercising. Within a year, Neil was so fit and trim, he was able to scramble to the roof of a 3-story building and hang off the flagpole like Spider-Man. "You're back," he told himself. But if I really wanted to learn, Neil pointed out, I was in the wrong parking lot. I took his advice and found myself a few weeks later struggling to the top of a 20-foot retaining wall in a London housing project, while a woman, half my size and twice my strength, stretched out a hand to help me over the top. Ordinarily, the climb wouldn't have been that tough, but after 2 hours of Shirley Darlington's wild urban obstacle course, my legs and arms were jelly. Every Thursday, Shirley blasts an email to the 100 or so members of her all-female crew, revealing the secret location for that night's challenge. She keeps the venue a surprise, so her crew never knows what to expect. And she keeps guys away because the biggest threat to parkour, as even the Yamakasi would agree, is testosterone. Young guys turn up, and lots of times all they want is the flash and not the fundamentals, says Dan Edwards, the master instructor who gave Shirley her start. They want to backflip off a wall and leap around on rooftops. With a group of lads, you'll get the show-off, the questioner, the giddy one. But in a women's group, there's none of that. It's very quiet. They get to it. Back in 2005, Dan stepped in to solve a problem the Yamakasi weren't equipped to handle. No one outside the Yamakasi inner circle really knew what parkour was supposed to be, and the Yamakasi weren't interested in explaining. David Bell is an artist, not a teacher. He wants to create new moves, not break down old ones. The only way you could get into it was if you were determined and crazy enough to find some guys practicing and try to keep up, Dan explains. There was no teaching, no guidance. Dan was in the same fix, but he got lucky. He met Francois Forrest Mayhop, a Yamakasi acolyte living in the tough London borough of Westminster. Forrest agreed to let Dan shadow him, and at that moment, a crime-fighting duo was formed.
There's a lot of gun crime in the area, a lot of knife crime, Forrest would explain. A lot goes on after dark that most people don't see.
A Westminster rec director saw Dan and Forrest leaping around the city one day and realized they were doing exactly what kids are always told not to. In his mind, wheels started whirring. The more they tried to keep youngsters off the streets at night, the more they rebelled. Since they were going to run wild anyway, why not run wild under adult supervision? He asked if Forrest and Dan would teach a few sample classes on Friday nights, just to see whether it could keep some bodies off the streets. As a government body, that was visionary, Dan marveled. In France, parkour was vilified. But when the rest of the Westminster City Council found out, they were appalled.
They thought we were going to train kids to escape the police, Forrest would recall.
Most UK schools believe parkour was so dangerous and rebellious, they wouldn't even allow it on the playgrounds. In the United States, a university graduate student made headlines when campus police tasered and handcuffed him after mistaking his parkour training for a drug episode. On a personal note, I was disinvited from a speaking event at a public library when I mentioned I'd be talking about parkour. Anything that wild and daring
has to be a magnet for juvenile delinquents. And it was. More than 100 kids turned up for the debut session, and it was bedlam. Then Forrest and Dan got to work. They began hammering home the parkour ethic. Respect your environment, respect other people, and taking the young thugs out in the streets to train. They reappropriate their city space, Dan says. They're less likely to vandalize or litter or cause trouble if they have ownership of it. Soon, something changed. We saw young people that a couple of weeks ago were swearing at them in the classroom. Now they're nodding and saying, "Yes, Dan, yes, Forrest," says Corey Wharton Malcolm, the Westminster Sports Development Officer. To be able to watch that change over a period of weeks is amazing. The police were even more dumbfounded. Metropolitan Police came back and said crime among that age group had dropped 69%, which was a mind-blowing stat, Dan says. 69%? That was a huge validation that this actually works. Dan felt a change coming over himself as well. Until then, I was about improving myself. Now I thought, right, let's see how many people we can reach and how far we can take it. Dan's next frontier arrived in the form of a single mum playing wingman for her nervous cousin. Shirley Darlington was 16 when she dropped out of high school to help support her family after her father died, and 19 when she had a baby of her own. Shirley knew she'd boxed herself into a bleak future, so she began scrambling for a way out. She sold sneakers by day while getting her high school degree at night, then began university studies while creating a job for herself with the Health Council as a mentor for other teen mums. "I had to grow up fast," she explains. "I was working full-time and caring for an infant. I didn't have time to play." She had two other reasons for begging off when her cousin was too shy to go to parkour alone. "Never heard of it," and, "God, I haven't exercised since PE class in school 5 years ago." Shirley eventually caved and regretted it. She and her cousin arrived for the Westminster class and found themselves alone in a sea of lads pulling themselves over brick walls twice as high as their heads. But the heckling and the babying they expected never came. When Shirley and her cousin struggled with a drill, two of the lads who'd already finished silently circled back and completed it by their side. There's no written code for parkour, but pretty much everywhere you find the same principles, Dan says. At some point, even the strongest person freezes on a jump. It teaches you humility and reminds you where you came from. That's why no one ever finishes a challenge alone. Even from the beginning, with the Yamakasi, Dan points out, parkour was always about community. Dan began having his own visionary breakthrough. Night after night, he watched Shirley show up for class, even though she was weak and clumsy, and usually exhausted from work and class and pre-dawn baby feedings. For 2 years, Shirley struggled to do her first pull-up. "She used to just hang from the bar," Dan says. "She'd pull and pull, and she wouldn't move one centimeter." But she continued showing up and grabbing for the bar until a year later, Shirley nailed her first muscle-up, a challenging and essential parkour maneuver in which you continue the pull-up until you're waist-high on the bar and can vault yourself on top. By her 5th year, Shirley was not only outperforming the men, like a modern-day Atalanta, she'd become the one circling back to help struggling lads. The real obstacle wasn't strength, she discovered. It was trust. "I never knew what my body could do, so it took a long time to build the confidence to throw my full weight into a movement," Shirley says. "Once I did, it changed everything." "It's great we're winning over young guys and thinning out the predators," Dan thought as he watched Shirley's transformation. "But what if we also empowered everyone else?" In 2005, only 5 women in the world practiced parkour, which Dan found insane. "The time has come for all of us, men and women alike, to adapt to the world we now live in," Dan believes. By the year 2050, after all, 6 of every 7 people on the planet will live in a city. We have to shape our training to fit our lifestyle, Dan says. We're no longer surrounded by trees, so we have to learn to climb walls. Dan began playing with an idea. What if women discovered they could be just as strong in the city as they were in the wild? What if they knew they could climb, run, jump, and adapt as powerfully as any man? Dan couldn't really make the case himself, being a man, but he knew someone who could. On the Thursday morning I arrived in London, my phone pinged with a message from Shirley. Kilburn Tube Station, 7 p.m. I got there 10 minutes early, but about 20 women were already warming up, including the British movie actress Christina Chong and her sister Lizzie, a professional dancer. We set off at a jog, arriving about a half mile later at a cement courtyard in the middle of a high-rise housing project. Shirley had us line up at the top of a long, zigzagging access ramp and drop to all fours. We monkey-walked on hands and feet about 40 yards to the bottom, then bunny-hopped up the stairs and did it again backwards, then crab-style, then squat-hopping, each time with a new twist and a push-up between circuits. By the 13th loop, my hands were cement-scuffed and my head was spinning from being at knee-height for so long. But the parade of hopping, bear-crawling, push-upping women showed no sign of slowing. I looked around for Shirley, but she disappeared into our midst. The best parkour coaches are invisible, Dan told me. They get you started, then get out of the way. I spotted her again when 3 men took a seat on the wall and began sharing a smoke and loud comments on the women's bodies. Shirley quietly peeled off from the circuit and trotted over to a swing set. She leaped for the crossbar and, in a blur, somehow ended up squatting on top. It's become her signature move, and it's a showstopper. Not long ago, she teamed up with Felicity Fizz Hood and Anne-Thérèse Anti-Marais for an extraordinary YouTube clip called Movement of Three. In little more than 2 minutes, the 3 cat-leap up and over a 7-foot wall, land precision jumps on 2-inch guardrails, execute a hand-to-hand traverse along a rooftop railing, and then Anti and Fizz catapult themselves through a swing set while the single mum who couldn't do a pull-up when she began parkour squats on the bar above their heads, perfectly balanced while blowing soap bubbles. This time, Shirley lowers herself from the bar with such slow grace and power that the 3 mopes on the wall shove their cigarettes in their mouths so their hands are free to applaud. Moving on, Shirley's tribe is heading out, so I have to sling my bag on my back in a hurry and sprint to catch up. For the next 2 hours, Northwest London is our playground. Shirley leads us to metal benches, where we practice diving into shoulder rolls and popping back up on a dead run. She finds a butte of a wall, where we work on running arm jumps, running straight up the bricks, basically, and grabbing for the top of the wall, and hoisting ourselves up when momentum dies and gravity takes over. Well after dark, we're all clinging to a railing as we traverse a cement wall in a hanging squat. My feet are slipping, and I'm in danger of dropping off when Lizzie Chong tucks in beside me. "Get your knees higher," she says. "You're relying on your arms, but this is about legs." Step by step, we work our way to the end, then drop to all fours and bear crawl on hands and feet back to the beginning. Press out our 40th or so push-up of the night and get ready for another loop. I try to thank Lizzie for the help, but she waves me off. "I needed a hand to hold when I started because I thought it was too dangerous," she said. "If I break an ankle, that's my career." But after her first class, she was hooked. I could see the dance in it, the flow, the rhythms, the strength and danger. You're always on the edge of fear because your body senses it can do more than your mind will let it. By the time Shirley cuts us loose for the night, I never want to do parkour again and can't wait to come back. I didn't just run and climb all over northwest London. I still had its cement grit deep under my fingernails. This must be what George Sikandakis meant when he said a true Cretan citizen is a dromaeus, a runner, I thought. Someone who can handle any obstacle and circle his hometown like a guardian spirit. Chapter 21. We're heading into Evader's country, Chris called back, leading us off the crags and across some jagged stone flats towards the Samaria Gorge, baddest of the Badlands. It's where a lot of Allied soldiers hid after they were left behind by the evacuation. Samaria is a thunderbolt in stone, a thin gash that splits two rock towers and zigzags 11 miles upward from the beach until it crests on a grassy mountain plateau. It's a terrific place to hide because the walls are honeycombed with caverns. Tuck inside one and dislodging you could be lethal. No one can get down to you from above, and coming up from below means crossing your kill zone. During the war, the gorge became a free-for-all zone for evaders, who could see pursuers coming from miles away and scamper down to the beach whenever they heard rumors of a rescue boat, and the wind boys, Cretan desperados whose only allegiance was to their own cutthroat gang. George had his own run-in with the wind boys while he and another guerrilla were crossing the gorge with a message for the resistance. George played it cool, bantering with them cautiously from halfway behind a boulder while covering them with the pistol in his pocket. But his partner ran for it. The wind boys caught him with a rifle shot, and in the turmoil, George vanished among the rocks and slipped off. Miraculously, George found his partner the next day, passed out miles away from a bullet wound through his arm. George got him to a gorilla's den, then pushed on with his mission. The White brothers and I slept at the base of the gorge, but not for long. By 3 a.m. we were up and setting off for the trailhead. Climbing the gorge is daunting on a good day, especially when you tilt your head way back and realize you'll be walking through those clouds overhead and still be a good way from the top. We took another look at the clouds, glowing in a milky moon. If they opened up, we were in trouble. We'd be pinned in a water chute where going back down would be as risky as pushing on up.
It had to be terrifying for the Germans, Pete mused, jumping out of a plane over an island full of born murderers who all hate you. Survive that, and they send you into this place.
He jerked his head toward the rainforest foliage around the dark trail,
to hunt men who are better at hunting you.
Lovely. I wasn't surprised by the scope of Pete's empathy. His chosen career, after all, is nurturing plants and teaching learning disabled adults to create with their hands. But it was eerie to suddenly be reminded how horrifying this wilderness used to be. It's hard not to feel tiny and trapped at the bottom of a canyon, especially when you begin to sense all the invisible eyes once hidden by its caves and gnarled trees. The gorge still has that feeling of menace and evil opportunity, at least until the sun comes up. By mid-morning, we were bumping into a few downhill hikers, and then a merry stream. Samaria has become a popular tourist route, but only in one direction. Groups are dropped off at the top by bus, then picked up at the bottom by ferry and hauled back to their beach hotels. Heading up, we were alone. We crested the trail by early afternoon, climbing out of the woods into a freezing mountain wind and a light patter of rain. We took a breather before pushing on to Laki, a village somewhere on the far side of the grassy Omalas Plateau. As we tore into sardines and chunks of bread from our packs, we watched a man snipping something by the side of the road and shoving it into a blue plastic grocery bag. Pete walked over for a closer look and discovered one of the special weapons of the Cretan resistance.
"It's nasturtium," Pete reported back, "an orange weed with tasty leaves and flowers. Like most places, Crete has weeds growing in every stony crack. But unlike most places, Cretans devour them. Weeds of all stripe, dandelion, purslane, chicory, sorrel, are picked and braised and tossed together in a peppery mix called orta. With a citrusy squirt of lemon,
and a little olive oil for fat and flavor, Otta is a nutritional powerhouse of iron, calcium, omega-3 fatty acids, plus an alphabet soup of vitamins. For a man on the run, it was a lifesaver. Superfood fixins were nearly everywhere, nearly any time, and always fresh and delicious. Unless you had Paddy's palate, that is. He hated Otta, says Artemis Cooper, but he had to respect it. Oddly, I discovered a living handbook of the ancient Cretan eating arts in the form of a ballerina prowling Brooklyn's Prospect Park. When she's not teaching dance in Manhattan or choreographing new pieces, Leda Meredith likes to walk the park in both winter and summer and stuff her backpack with foraged findings, garlic mustard and peppergrass, lemony sorrel and asparagus-like pokeberry shoots, gummy mallow leaf and tangy lamb's quarter and delectable ginkgo. Yes, ginkgo, those horrific gooey globules that litter city sidewalks every spring and stink up the bottom of your shoes. I have to race Koreans for the ginkgo, Leda mentioned when we set off into the park one September morning. If I'm too slow, all I'll find is the remains where they field-dressed a pile. You take the fruit, squeeze off the yellow squishy part, and save the kernels for roasting. Delicious. I figured the early autumn cold snap meant we'd come home empty-handed, but within 4 feet, Leda had already spotted prey. Lamb's quarter, she exulted, easing a leafy clump out of the lawn. She singled out a strand and pointed to the powdery coating on the arrowhead leaves. They look dusty, right? That's your identifier. I've seen this all over every lawn I've ever mowed, I said. It's edible? It's like kale and chard, Leda said. It sells for $7.50 a pound in the Park Slope Co-op. But guess what? It's growing in the sidewalk right out front. Leda squatted and came up with a fistful of another weed I'd seen forever. She pointed out its tiny pink flowers and the dark smudge on a slender, droopy leaf, which resembles the smudge of an inky thumb. Lady's thumb. It's a little bitter, but chop it into a salad with some sorrel, and it's wonderful. It's from the buckwheat family, so it's packed with nutrients. As a girl, Leda learned the art of foraging from her Greek immigrant family in San Francisco. Leda's mother was a ballerina with a Los Angeles ballet company, so Leda was raised mostly by her grandmother. Every spring, there came a moment when Yaya Lopi, my great-grandmother, stubbed out her cool menthol cigarette and declared that it was the right day to gather Otta in the park, Leda explains. The timing had to be just right. Too soon and the leaves would be too small. Too late and they'd be too bitter. Yaya was the expert on when to go because she'd grown up picking wild edibles in Greece. Back in the kitchen, the women steamed the greens and mixed them with olive oil and chopped garlic. Their eyes would gleam, Leda notes. The first wild greens of spring were better to them than chocolate. Leda followed her mother into dance, winning a full scholarship to the American Ballet Theatre, and later signing with the Manhattan Ballet. But she still kept roaming the parks for feral foods, once shocking prima ballerina Cynthia Gregory by sliding in next to her at a dinner party with her arms covered with raw scratches from reaching between thorny branches. During downtime between dance tours, Leda would spend months harvesting olives with her relatives in Greece or traveling Europe and California as a seasonal fruit picker, happy to be surrounded by fragrant, pluckable, biteable life. She began taking classes in ethnobotany at the New York Botanical Garden and studying with the yup, that's her real name herbalist, Susan Weed. Leda would lead her friends and fellow dancers on all-day hunt and picks, then bring the famished hikers back to her apartment and teach them how to cook their haul. As her performance career came to an end, Leda realized she'd been working on her new calling since she was 6 years old. The Parks Department has a limited weed control budget, which is great for me, she says. Lida now leads foraging tours and teaches classes at both the New York and Brooklyn Botanical Gardens. "People have no idea what's right here," she adds. "Streams and ponds all over the Northeast are thick with watercress, a leafy green superfood that outscores spinach and chard as the most nutritionally dense of all vegetables. Often, however, wild watercress is mistaken as a nuisance weed and either discarded or ignored. Like this," Lida points to a cabbagey mess I've grown to hate on sight. "As a kid, I scraped my knuckles bloody every summer trying to dig those things out of sidewalk cracks in front of the house." "That's burdock," Lida explains. "It grows in cities where nothing else will, and it's fabulous." Burdock has a long, thick taproot that's a bear to unearth, but take it home and slice it into a stir-fry, and you've got a plateful of the Japanese delicacy gobo. The challenge for beginners is knowing what you're yanking. Crete alone has more than 100 varieties of wild edible greens. Many look identical, but have different flavors and aromas, not to mention nutritional and medicinal benefits. "Stomach problems, skin disorders, breathing difficulties, even emotional uneasiness. You can treat them all with so-called weeds," Lida explains. "It's too bad we've developed this mentality that if it's free and natural, it can't be good." Actually, a closer look shows that this Cretan snack, stuffed with wild greens, packs more nutritional punch than just about any fruit or vegetable you can buy. When scientists from Austria and Greece performed a chemical analysis of a Cretan fried pie in 2006, they were struck by two things: the sheer variety of the filling and the sky-high levels of vitamins, antioxidants, and essential fatty acids. The bite-sized crescents, called calitsunia, are typically packed with a combination of fennel, wild leeks, sal thistle, heartwort, corn poppy, sorrel, and Queen Anne's lace, all of it growing wild and calorically dense. In most cases, the researchers found, the wild greens had higher micronutrient content than those cultivated. Even more intriguing, greens keep Cretans in harmony with 2 million years of human history. For most of our ancestral existence, humans maintained a healthy balance between omega-6 fatty acids, which provide a healthy amount of protective inflammation, and omega-3s, which keep inflammation in check. Overdo it with omega-6, and you become high risk for heart disease and neurological disorders. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors had a 1-to-1 ratio. Today, ours is more like 16-to-1. Since the proliferation of vegetable and soybean oils in processed foods, omega-6 consumption has been through the roof. Instead of a small fire to warm the house, we've created an inferno that's burning it down. Except on Crete. By including daily wild greens in their diet, the population of Crete was able to supplement their diet not only with vitamins and antioxidants, but also with essential fatty acids in a ratio similar to that kept by the local Minoan population 4,500 years ago, the researchers found. The traditional diet of Crete, they add, is similar to the ratio kept during human evolution. But for beginners, foraging is bewildering. Books aren't much help. Greens all kind of look the same on the page, and they're usually photographed in blossom when the pictures are prettiest, but the prime plucking period has already passed. Luckily, Lida came up with a genius solution. Let hatred be your guide. "Do you have something around your house you can't stand?" she asked. "Nettles," I immediately replied. "Burn nettles. I can't get rid of it." "Stop trying. You're lucky. Nettles are free spinach. Cooking or drying neutralizes the sting, and what you're left with is a tasty, leafy green that makes a great lasagna, pesto, soup, or pizza topping." "If you hate it, you'll recognize it," Lida explains. "Start with 2 or 3 things you see all the time, like dandelions and lady's thumb, and add things you hate, like nettles, and that's plenty to keep you busy as you expand your visual vocabulary." And like the evaders on Crete, who scramble to feed themselves from the harsh stones of the Samaria Gorge, it won't be long before you realize that everything you need to survive and thrive is right at your feet. From the top of the Samaria Gorge, Chris White took aim for the hilltop village of Lackey. By map, it was only a few miles off, but that meant nothing on an island where geography is measured by degree of difficulty rather than distance. We found a faint footpath, but when it climbed into the rocky highlands and disappeared, we seized on a free guide service, goats. Goats head back to the fold as it gets dark, and since there was nothing else between us and Lackey, all we had to do was follow the coppery clong of their bells, and they'd lead us right to the village.
"Wait, wait, wait!"
Chris threw his arms wide to stop us. He was staring down at a long drop a few inches from his feet, and remembering a crucial detail we'd forgotten. Goats have a much different approach to risk management. Our guides had bounded right over the edge, hopping along a staircase of tiny perches that was impossible to follow without hooves or ropes. We had to back up and bushwhack a new route, which failed. So we reversed course, tried again, failed again. By the time we got off the cliff, the bells were long gone. We found a dry creek bed and decided to stick with it, clambering over driftwood jams and rock washes until, just before nightfall, we reached the last hill below Lackey. Thank heaven, 14 hours of hard trail were coming to an end. An hour later, Lackey was no closer. The village was right there. We could see it. We could smell it as the wood smoke from evening fires drifted down. But we could not get there. We'd pushed our way through brambles and climbed rock walls, but every route we tried was a dead end or a semicircle, dropping us right back in the creek bed. The stinking hill was bewitched. To hell with it, Pete dropped to his belly and began to claw his way straight up, kneeing and pulling himself along like a man escaping quicksand. Chris and I watched, knowing he wouldn't get far before he hit an unclimbable cliff and gave up. Then we shrugged, dropped to our bellies, and followed. Stupid movement seemed better than no movement at all. Instead of a cliff, Pete came to an ancient stack of lava rock, wedged nicely into the hill like a climbing wall, and on the far side, a muddy pen behind a lonely farmhouse. We crawled up and sploshed through and came out to find the road. "You pull any stunts out there," I thought, as we trudged under the early evening moon into the tiny village. "You better know what you're doing." We were filthy, exhausted, and shivering. It was hard to fathom sleeping a few hours in a cave and setting off to do it again, or racing up that hill with a hostile German general in tow to save our own lives. Chapter 22. Chan Fielding had a plan to kidnap the German commanding officer and hold him as a hostage. Official British report of the Cretan resistance, 1941 to 1945. "Let's get the butcher." The idea was insane, but once it took hold in Paddy's mind, it refused to let go. "Let's make the butcher disappear." If Paddy could learn what the clown knew, he might just be able to pull it off. It would be a masterpiece of street magic, the perfect crime perpetrated on one of the world's worst criminals, a man protected by 5 divisions of German troops suddenly vanishing without a trace. George Sikondakis liked to tell the British secret agents he'd teach them the Cretan art of sheep stealing so they could go home after the war with a practical skill. Well, this was his chance. They'd bring the rules of the shepherd to the battlefield. But for a romantic poet, Paddy had a hard-nosed side. He'd lived by his wits during his years on the road and understood the difference between striving and surviving. Getting the butcher wasn't the biggest problem. The biggest problem would be getting away. As far as Paddy knew, No one had even thought of kidnapping a general before. Colin Gubbins had written an entire Art of Guerrilla Warfare manual for SOE agents after Churchill put him in charge of training, but nothing in there related to sneaking a general through enemy lines and off a fortified island. Nothing, that is, except Gubbins's motto. To inflict damage and death on the enemy and to escape scot-free has an irritant and depressing effect. The object must be to strike hard and disappear before the enemy can strike back. And in a peculiar way, John Pendlebury was proving it. About the time Paddy arrived in June, information was surfacing from Cretans who'd been with Pendlebury during the invasion. Bit by bit, it was beginning to sound as if he'd never made it to the White Mountains at all. In fact, Pendlebury may have been killed while Allied troops were still being evacuated from the island. Fragments of the story were still coming together, but if true, then for nearly a year, the Germans had been chasing a dead man. Even in death, Pendlebury was still in the fight. Maybe that was the best Paddy and George could hope for. I had read somewhere that the average life of an infantry officer in the First World War was 8 weeks, and I had no reason to think that the odds would be much better in the second, Paddy acknowledged. He was even more at risk as a sabotage agent, and if a mountain-hardened, Crete-savvy outdoorsman like Pendlebury couldn't make it, what chance did Paddy have? Likewise, George knew he was a marked man. German stormtroopers had already tried to trap him once in his village. They'd be back. The noose was tightening. So why not die a hunter rather than the hunted? When the Germans captured Athens, they ordered the old flag keeper at the Acropolis to lower the Greek flag and replace it with a swastika-emblazoned Reichskriegsflagge. Konstantinos Koukidis obediently took down the Greek flag, then wrapped himself in it and dived headfirst from a battlement. The Germans raised the Reichskriegsflagge over his corpse, but a few nights later, two Greek teenagers snuck behind the guards, cut it down, and ran for it. The Gestapo issued a death order for the two boys and anyone harboring them, but months afterwards, they were still on the loose. At a time when no force on earth seemed powerful enough to defy the Nazis, two boys electrified Europe by honoring an old man's sacrifice and snatching Hitler's flag. Imagine snatching one of his generals. There was one chance of pulling it off, Paddy figured. They'd have to become as strong and wily as the clown. They'd have to master the art of survival in those merciless mountains, as Paddy called them, and rely on whatever it was the clown did out there, running, climbing, dodging, conniving, foraging on the fly. They'd have to go places the Germans couldn't, and move faster and more nimbly than anyone thought possible. They'd have to follow in the footsteps of Odysseus, that other inventive and unstoppable Greek, and try to forget that, out of all his crew, only Odysseus made it home alive. Oddly, both Paddy and Chan had come up with the same idea on their own. Before Paddy told Chan about his plan to snatch the butcher, Chan was already mulling the possibility of grabbing a general to protect the villagers from German attacks. "We grab the bugger, tie him up, and tell the Jerrys whatever they do to a Cretan, we do to him." It was an idea worth considering, but first Chan would have to endure a different ordeal. George led him through the night to a tiny village in the mountains, and there, ready to celebrate Christmas, were Paddy and Tom Dunbabin, another Oxford archaeologist who'd been sent to replace Monty Woodhouse. The three men were positive the Germans would ease up for the holidays. Well, pretty positive. So they threw themselves into the full onslaught of Cretan merrymaking. "We reeled happily from home to home, eating and drinking with hosts who seemed as carefree as though no Germans had ever been heard of in Crete," Chan recalled. "We found the same conditions in every village we passed during our slow 3-day procession down the valley." Paddy knew the Germans weren't having this kind of fun, because he'd heard them say so. Shortly before Chan's return, the firm sent Paddy on a mission to blow up German warships with some magnetic mines. Paddy infiltrated the port and quickly made his assessment.
Not bloody likely. They wanted him to swim across the harbour between